Evening, everybody. Nice to see you. Thanks for coming out tonight. I was really struck by that reading. So much came forth for me. Because, you know, when you attempt to present this kind of material, what happens is you read it, you mull it over, you know, you become a little frightened, you know, like, do I have any idea what I'd be talking about? Just blabbing on. And so you have to go through a lot of personal work. And, you know, as I was reading this, I recalled how so much of, you know, I think benefit I've received from doing a medicine Buddha practice. And I remember when I was first met Trungpa Rinpoche, you know, fairly early on. I asked him the sort of typical beginner question, which wasn't exactly a dumb question, but I said, what happens if you get enlightened? You know, do you just disappear? And, you know, there's one school of thought that, you know, nirvana is extinction, and you're finished. I said, no, there's still energies. And so I didn't quite know what that meant, and I'm still, you know, working with that on a personal level. But the Medicine Buddha, I see, is, you know, what the Medicine Buddha did as his vow, when he assumed the Bodhisattva path. I don't know if he had a meditation teacher that he related to, but anyway, he realizes that he needed to be helpful to others because he could not exclude others from his heart. And so his vow is that as Linda was reading, that people would hear his name, would be freed from their attachment and rigid fears and attachment to the lower realm kinds of activities. And, you know, I really feel that it has been helping me. I don't know how much progress I've made, but I do feel like this practice has been very helpful for me. And when I see the Medicine Buddha and I do this practice, there's a part of me that says, you know, could be just as real as I think I am. Maybe, you know. And I was left wondering with this thought, and we could have discussed this for the whole evening, but then it might be a good idea. But here's a question for you to think about, please. And actually, it's two questions, but they relate to each other. What is a sentient being? And the mirror image of that, you might say, is, what is a thought? And something to think about. And maybe if there's time, I'll tell you a story, a Zen story that I've heard. But anyway, as I was getting ready for this talk, this evening, I was struggling. By the way, let me tell you, I'm a little bit disorganized because I was on call on the weekend, and today, the person who's supposed to relieve me for call, I work at the Victoria General Hospital with teenagers in crisis. And the person who was supposed to take over was ill. So I had to go in and deal with some kids who were sick, you know, having problems. And when I prepare for a talk normally, I start reading a week or so in advance, or 2 weeks in advance, and then, you know, reading and contemplating and studying. And then I usually have several hours the day of the talk to get ready. But today I didn't have that time because I was in there dealing with these kids. And what really struck me, this is a very personal thing, but I think it applies, is I was looking at these teenagers, who I have had to meet a few and work with a few, and you know they're interesting. Some of you may know teenagers. But if you work with children, you know, you look at children and they're adorable. You look at them and they're so cute. And you just melt your heart. Oh, they're so sweet. I love them. You know, they're so sweet. And the word, you know, the word innocent, I'm big on etymology, means something like blessed by God, something like that. It has those kinds of feelings. They're innocent. And adults, you know, you can kind of engage because we're working on something together. But teenagers, they're in a different world. You know, they are really in a different world. It's true. And you try to get through it. They try to get through it, but it's like, ooh, there's something in the way. It doesn't, you know, it's kind of, but I was struck today by how hard they have to work especially, you know, maybe all of them do, but the kids that I see who have had so much trouble, so much abandonment, so much abuse and conflict and neglect, and, you know, and you sit there and you think, how brave they must be to have to struggle through day by day. So anyway, I was doing that today. But you know, it sort of feeds back to what I was going to talk about. And start off, what I realized as I was going along here was this set of chapters, the one that we covered last month that Rabbi Hazel covered, which is the something like the acquisition of enlightened attitude. And today we're going to start into, well, now we're really going to go do it. You know, it was such a big shift. And I thought, as I was reading it, I thought, you know, I think the key to really understanding this is to revisit the beginning a little bit. And when we started the Jewel Ornament Liberation, do you remember what we started, how we started, what the topic, what the subject was? I mean, there were a number of subjects, but what was the main topic? How do we start? If you don't, that's okay, because I'll tell you. Well, Buddha nature. He starts off by saying, you know, the motive, samsara, nirvana, there you go. But beneath that, there's this Buddha nature which sees that quality. And you know what I realize is that what the teachings say, I don't like to say, use the term Buddhism. I don't think it's an ism as such. I think it's because an ism for me is something that keeps solidifying itself. And the Buddha Dharma is something that as you understand more and more, the Buddha, the label dissolves. And, you know, as they say, when you get to the other shore, you don't need the boat, but you use it to help others. Or, you know. So what we say about, talk about in the Dharma is that all beings have Buddha nature, no matter how confused, how difficult, you know, how much trouble they've caused and how screwed up they seem to be, that all sentient beings have Buddha nature. It may be hidden away, very hard to reach, but it's there. So I went back to looking at a book here, an early book, and it was called Heart of the Buddha. I have a lot of notes and stickies here. And I thought I would read something about Buddha nature here. And he says, the heart of the Buddha is a very open heart that I would like to explain, that would like to explore the phenomenal world. It is open to relating to others. This heart, it's talking about Buddha nature, this is the beginning of the path, you know, early, what is it? First chapter. This heart contains tremendous strength and confidence in itself, which is called fearlessness. That heart is also extremely inquisitive, which at this point is synonymous with prajna. It is expansive and sees all in all directions. And that heart contains certain basic qualities which we could call basic genes, our Buddha genes. We all possess these particular Buddha genes. Isn't it strange to say that mind has genes? But it turns out to be true. These Buddha genes have two characteristics. First, they are able to see through, as well as not be afraid of, the reality of the phenomenal world. Means we're able to, doesn't mean we always recognize that and take advantage of it, but we might come up with obstacles and difficulties of all kinds, but these particular genes are not afraid to deal with them. We just shed the coverings of such possibilities as we go along. Second, these genes also contain gentleness. They are ever so loving, which goes beyond just being kind. They are extremely tender and capable of reflecting themselves even to those who don't want to relate with them. And they are absolutely free from any form of aggression. They are so soft and kind. These Buddha genes are also full of a sense of humor and delight, which is really referred to as great joy. And everything is uplifted in this humor. So this is what we start from.
Is this Chogyam Trungpa speaking or Gyalpopa?
Chogyam Trungpa. Yeah, I'm sorry I didn't make that clear. This book is called The Heart of Buddha, and it's dated 1991, Trungpa's Rinpoche speaking. When he gave his talk, I'm not sure. Probably a few years before that. But this is him talking about this Buddha nature, which we all possess. You know, and when I hear this, I think, oh, you know, could it be? Could it be? You know, and yes, it could be. Could be, and it is. So what we do is we hear about this, and we have to work to make this come about. You know, so I will now turn to page 109, where it says, so taking the only way to break the chain reaction of confusion and pain is to work our way outward into awakened state of mind, is to take responsibility ourselves. Now he's talking here about the Bodhisattva vow, but the beginning is that even though we have this pure nature, this wakefulness, when I hear him describe that, I think, you know, it actually cheers me up to hear it. But he also says that we have to work on ourselves, which is the first part of what we do in our path. And interestingly enough, then he says, as we go along, what we find out is as we learn to work on ourselves, you're actually engaged, working with the difficulties we have and recognizing our patterns and, you know, knowing that we can go through them, letting drop what, you know, we hold on to so rigidly, that we begin to see that we are workable and our world is workable. You know, so as he says here, in the next page, that everything is basically workable, and there's room for everything, and we work with it. And what he said is, you know, it's interesting when he, in Gampopa, if you had a chance to read one or translation of it, you know, the Gampopa was in a very polite way. But sometimes you will find that sentient beings are not nice to you. More or less. He says, you know, we have to be complete, you know, with that we can't be tired and put off by people's heavy-handed neurosis, their ego dirt, their ego puke, or ego diarrhea. Instead, we have to be willing to put up with this for the sake of their own development. So, you know, I remember, I was talking about this once. I remember him giving a talk. I'm not sure where it's recorded, but he was talking about when you work with people, that sometimes it's like you have to see that they're like babies and you're changing their diaper. And he said, did I ever tell you this line? He said, it's like they squirt, as you're changing their diapers. They squirt diarrhea in your face. If you don't let that bother you, just go ahead, wipe it off and go on. You know. So Trungpa Rinpoche used very earthy language type. One of the things I really appreciate about him, his teaching, is that, you know, I mean, not only does he convey, I think, you know, the pure ideas, but he does it in a language and metaphor and imagery that really goes to the heart of how we experience things. So we work with sentient beings. And what the idea of the Bodhisattva path, training this, is that we do not renounce sentient beings. We do not cut them out. We do not, renounce, take them out of our mind. We do not give up our thoughts about sentient beings, no matter what they do. So what I thought I would do is I have a little exercise that I'd like to do that might help. Yes, I have two exercises, actually. You know, I did the talk, Becky and I have been alternating, and I did the talk about impermanence. And I got very inspired, if you were after that talk, about how if you recognize impermanence, that you see a vividness in the teachings. It's hard to see if you just casually think things, you know, will go on as they look like they're going to. You know, like, But I found a little physical exercise helpful for pointing out to myself the fact of impermanence. And I would like to demonstrate to you, I'll tell you what I'm going to do, and this will be the first exercise that you can do if you want. And if you want to do it, you can do it yourself, if you have any doubts about impermanence. And this is how I do the exercise. I came across this. So what I do is I take a deep breath and I blow the air out slowly through my pursed lips. And I notice, if I blow it very slowly, I notice how long I can blow the air out. Now, I will do it now. And if you feel motivated, try. It might scare you, so be careful. I don't want anybody to have, you know, get awful frightened and have a panic attack, but it sends a message. And so I'm going to do it. If you feel like doing it, yeah, you know, I we'll see how it goes. Right? Pretty good.
Is that one breath that you did?
One breath, yeah.
Oh my goodness. That's excellent.
Now, did anybody have a feeling that the breath was going to go on for almost forever? Did it seem like it just kept going and going? Yeah? Okay.
My mind told me, no, it's not going to happen.
It doesn't, you know, like really reinforced to me the fact that I don't have all day. All you know, forever, that this wonderful as it is temporary. Did anybody else get that? what was your reaction? Did anybody want to say anything about it?
Well, you have a sense that you're controlling it.
Mm-hmm.
But you know that it will end. And so, obviously, it was a little game, and I know that I can do this really well. It's something that I, mm-hmm. I can do. It makes that one breath last a long time. And so I was determined that I would last longer than you. Just a little game that I played.
Cornuto.
but never when, you know, did you ever think that wasn't going to end?
Well, see, for me, I hear what you're saying. And I take back my little epithet.
No, that's all right. I don't mind that at all.
No, but for me, what it made it physical. I actually felt it, you know, and I that was the crucial thing for me, is that I recognized that, you know, my body said, oh, yeah, all right, you're doing fine.
It's not just an intellectual exercise or something.
Yeah, it was, for me, it was quite physical.
Yeah, it becomes visceral and real in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah. So that's how, you know, so I like the physical part of it, so that's why I helped me. So it reminds me, you look like you're a little suspicious. What?
No, I'm curious. This is interesting.
Yeah, it was a physical pointer for me, you know, like, you know, in mindfulness. Yes?
I also found it gets harder near the end. You start panicking as you run out of breath. You know, as you get older, it gets more difficult. I'm not panicking yet, but I'm aware it's getting more difficult. And I'm, you know, you're coming down that last chute.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. You know, for those of us who are like, I'm pretty old, and I should know this, but there's part of it. Well, maybe. Well, could be the first one. Anyway, but I mean, the idea is that, you know, the physical point is, it's like when you do the three raising exercise with mindfulness-based stress reduction, you get these three raises. And you spend 5 minutes with each raising, yeah, because it becomes a physical experience of looking at the raising mindfully. Well, this is, to me, a physical experience of feeling that things are going on all of a sudden. Yeah. So, okay. Well, I have exercise number two. Well, the basic point, the reason I brought that exercise up is because it reinforced the fact that it's optional to practice, but it's not very wise not to practice. You know, I think it's very important to continue to work on myself. That's just, I have to take responsibility, so I don't have forever to do it, and I really need to work on myself quite diligently. So, now, the second exercise, though, is about something else. And I call this the Indra's net exercise. I'm looking. You alright? You're looking at me. Do you know about Indra's net?
Yes.
So you're good. Indra was one of the gods of the, apparently, in the Indian tradition, but it came down from the, in the Vedas, from apparently around the Caucasus, and, you know, this means the people, the Aryans, seemingly brought this, as they call themselves, the noble people brought this tradition into India, and Indra was the god, equivalent to Thor, or Jupiter, or what's his name, in the Greek tradition?
Zeus.
Zeus, yeah, it's very equivalent to that, so the father god. And Indra was, Zeus was the hurler of thunderbolts, I think. And no, Zeus was cloud gatherer Zeus, and Indra was the hurler of thunderbolts. So these guys deal with the weather and upper things on that. So, but in the Buddhist tradition, and in various Mahayana aspects of the Buddhist tradition, Indra's net is described as this. It's a net that extends infinitely in all directions. And at every interstices, I think it's called, where the strings in that intersect, there is a jewel. And the jewels in this net reflect the light of all the other jewels. So this is a Mahayana illustration, I think, or metaphor describing it. And I don't know whether Indra had a net before the Buddhists got onto us or not, but describing what may be called codependent origination, or you know, the interrelatedness of all things. Now I have a little exercise to illustrate Indra's net. So what I'd like you to ask you to join me in this exercise too. Right? I think for this we need to be in a circle, and I don't want to rearrange the cushions because people get all upset. So we could stand or just sit on cushions in a circle, and whatever you want to do, what would you rather do?
Stand.
Okay, can we stand in a circle? Yeah. What I'm going to do now is to...
Look at the jewels.
You and the jewels. They're coming.
Nothing's intersected.
Everybody hold the string, run the little circle, and you be more or less in a circle. Mm-hmm. Can you get in a circle? I'm going to give you some instructions for how to make this exercise work. So, don't tell anybody what's on your instruction sheet, okay? So I'm going to give you, let's see, this is a good one for you. Okay, let me see. We haven't done this before, have we?
No.
Don't come.
No.
Yeah, okay. So, really, I thought, you know, if you need glasses to read, I'll give it to you. Let's see, I think, I think you're over here. Okay. Pretty cool. Don't show anybody what you've got.
Intriguing.
Don't show anybody what you've got, John.
No, Mike, are you with us?
No, no. I'm feeling not that. Okay, I feel better now.
Now, did I do one of them? I did. Call the teacher. Okay, there she is. Walter, you got yours, right? Okay, now would you just do what the instructions say?
No, mine.
Me.
Me.
No, mine.
No,
mine.
You.
No,
mine.
No, mine.
Mine.
No, mine.
We all mine.
Me.
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 No,
mine.
Me.
No,
mine.
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 Okay. Me.
Mine.
So you could say, you could change the word to from I'm right, you're wrong. You could change it to anything. I'm better than you. I know more than you. It could be anything, couldn't it?
Well, is it all ego?
This is Imprisonet. This represents the what we have to work with. Because, you see, everybody's related. The point is that this represents, in a certain way, kind of an attempt to demonstrate Imprisonet. Because everybody's connected to everybody else. Are there any individuals? You know, who's to say? Sort of. But the individuals are all connected to each other. It's like the jewels, in a sense. If you see what's going on, then you can see that everybody's related. And while we all look different on the outside, there's a sense that ultimately, below that, you know, we're all connected as beings or so. But if we don't understand the whole network, if we don't understand the net, then you see we're living with an ordinary sense of the way life goes. Me. No, it's mine. You get it? And that is what we have to work through. So that's the idea of the exercise. What do you think?
It's really cool.
Thank you.
It's kind of comfortable here now.
Yeah.
Oh, we're falling apart.
Oh, dear.
Okay, so let's...
It's all yours.
All right, then.
Leslie's opting out.
I'm enlightening.
So, thank you. So if we can... We can just put that down.
Yeah. I'll wind it for you.
Are you okay? All right, good. So, back to your hand. Back to your hand, please.
Let's take the strands of...
Thank you. So I like the idea. For me, physically feeling things does it in a way that reading it doesn't quite do as well. So I hope that is okay.
Both exercises seem to have that physical representation of a mental state.
Yeah.
And actually, if we had to become like, if we had a manifest medium mind in an aggressive way, the net couldn't have existed. We would have destroyed the net.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Well, it certainly gets twisted out of shape.
Pardon?
At least get twisted out of shape, if not, destroyed and dysfunctional.
You see, for me, this real. Thank you. And if we don't understand it, if we don't see this relationship, how we're all, you know, of one heart, then it's me against you, me against the world, you know, and the battle is only going to end in spiritual bloodshed, you know, and everybody loses. So, thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate that. Maybe this went over better than the breathing. More fun, but... But I think what Trungpa Rinpoche says in his commentaries about the dual is that this bodhicitta, you know, which is this sense that, you know, we're all connected, is like the philosopher's stone that
The way he describes it, and I'm haven't read up about it that much, so I'll take your word for it, is it turns everything it touches to gold. And so the person, you know, the inspiration to work with the Mahayana path starts with a person who, you know, really has this, has worked with this, and the contact of that person inspires us to work on ourselves in the acquisition of the attitudes. By having the vision of working with others that we actually get inspired to do so. So the medicine Buddha, for instance, says, I want to help all beings so that just seeing this, the form of my inspiration, my wish. See, I think we become our inspiration. You might say that the physical form we have actually represents our inspiration in some way. And, you know, I really feel that when we're born, there's a sense of, there's a cry, but there's also a sense of triumph. You know, we're actually, that we're here. And then, of course, we have to go through all the other stuff, but there's a sense that his inspiration was such that by seeing this blue, luminous quality, we, you know, feel drawn to it. And, you know, we also feel you can, if you work with it enough, you start feeling like, really would be good to help others with whatever it is they're working with. And if you, even if you don't succeed, even if you repeatedly fail, you know, I feel myself that I've failed so many times, but you keep working on it. And, you know, allowing yourself to stumble, but you keep getting up and moving on your path. So that's, I think, really crucial to this Mahayana version, is that we recognize that we have sympathy towards ourselves. You know, we recognize that we are nurturing our own journey, and we have to be a good parent to ourselves, and we have to actually express love to ourselves, and the love that says, I know some of this is going to hurt, but I love you. You know, and I have found that telling myself that, I know that some of my day is going to hurt, some of my life is going to hurt, but I still love you. But I think that actually, if I work with that feeling, it's easier to actually give the, you know, have that emotional connection with others. So, and what I like about one of the things in the Jewel Ornament text is when he describes the Bodhisattva and the teacher, and it's on page 140, he says, his heart, or his or her heart, must drip with compassion for innumerable beings whom he or she considers to be their only child. So I love it. The heart drips with compassion. So that's a tall order. But there's a sense of what a wonderful sense of motivation that some being could have that much compassion for others. And at the same time, you know, when we say the four immeasurables, I think John Wuchin made this point, and I'm sure others say this, make this point as well, what we say is, may you be free from suffering and the root of suffering, may you be, have happiness and the root of happiness, and going with that. But the basic idea is, we cannot stop people from, you know, having their suffering. We're going to have pain, and we're going to have disappointment. And we can't always be happy, but we can help people accumulate the root of these positive feelings, knowing that karma, you know, our own karma, as Linda read about, that our karma helps us, building good karma helps us build a positive life, even if at times there are setbacks. So, in terms of going further, with this. I will have to talk about how we're going to, what the Jewel Armament talks about is the first thing you do is you don't, you know, you don't ever drop a sentient being from your heart, even if they give you a hard time, and that you continue to build in that regard, and you know, you recognize that you have to train yourself, and this is where I would have could use more time studying, but that you actually work with the practice, and you know, you avoid negative actions, the negative actions of you know, bad-mouthing teachers or deceiving the lineage, and you know, just taking from the monastery or whatever it is, you know, from the center, things you're not supposed to. One of the crucial things I thought was very important was not defaming someone who is trying to be helpful, even if they're not doing what looks like a very excellent job, you know. So if someone's motivation is good, even if it doesn't quite work, we don't say bad things about that person. And also, one of the other points that Jewel Armament makes is that you don't make people feel bad about themselves, just in general, you know. And so the aspiration part of, you know, building this bodhicitta up, you know, what we're going to get on in the next chapters is actually practicing the paramitas. And the first chapter 10, which I think I'm supposed to be presenting now, is about, you know, gathering the energy behind the aspiration. So the aspiration that I'm going to go through these paramitas. You know, all of this, recognizing bodhicitta, recognizing Buddha nature. We started out with that a year ago, wherever it was. Buddha nature is there. This is open heart, this heart of pure goodness. And then we studied how we have to train ourselves, recognizing things are permanent, recognizing, you know, karma, all the other things we studied. I can't remember those topics right now, but all those things, working with ourselves so that we gain a sense of being in control of our minds so they're not all over the place. And then now opening ourselves to recognizing that our heart is open and connected with the entire world. We are in Indra's net. So how do we actually work with this? Well, we don't let that realization dwindle. We nurture it and recognize that, in fact, we need to keep going with it. We actually need to devote ourselves to be better at helping people. And so the six paramitas are how we do that. And what he describes are, you know, the first two or three. First off, the paramitas build on themselves. Generosity helps build ethics and manners. Ethics and manners helps build the next one, which I think is patience or discipline, and then patience, and then prajna, and then wisdom. You know, so there's the six paramitas, and so they go from a relative, you know, benefiting others to ultimate wisdom, and as we progress along with those paramitas, we will move through, you know, as we perfect them, you kind of actually attain certain, you know, your own levels of awakenment called enlightenment, or, you know, bhumis on the path. They're actually called bhumis, or earths, levels of earth on the path as you go along. So if you have generosity, it's called the old joyful. When you really open your heart and become generous, which, you know, we probably do little bits here and there, but all of us do, I'm sure. But when we really resonate with it, it's the all-joyful first boom. Like, boom, awakening. And you see the brilliance of it. And then you're inspired. You're going to keep going and working. So then you develop the later paramitas, which we'll study. So I think I'm going to stop and ask if there are any comments or questions or what we can talk about further.
I'd like to think of there these centers jewels. So we think of it like sequins or jewels at each intersection.
Yeah.
So as you play with the net, you can enjoy watching the colors, you know, that's an option to saying mine, no, not yours, that kind of thing. Just enjoy watching the play of the colors.
No. Yeah, I think there is a lot of enjoyment in it, definitely.
Like I'm getting the image of a fishing net. It's full of the fish, but there's silver splashing in the sunlight.
Well, the jewels actually are light. There's light in each jewel. You know, so we're appreciating the little bit of nature in everybody. You know, I think that's really wonderful. I think that's a key, a really key aspect. You know, we were talking once about how to work with questions in Shambhala training. My sense is that there's three sides to when you work with someone's got a question about their practice or what they're doing. And the first side would be, you know, somebody says, blah, 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 what's this question? And you answer the question and you deal with the technicalities of the question. Then the second one is with the emotional side of it. You know, because if somebody's expressing usually some emotional. But the third side of the aspect is that whatever question somebody comes up with, there's always a kernel of wisdom in it to be highlighted. You know, it's not, there are no stupid questions. So, yeah.
You started out asking us what a sentient being is. I'd love to hear your answer to that. It's like a cool
Pardon?
It's like a cool drink of water.
Yeah. Well, you know, I thought about that. And what did Churchill say about Russia? Remember that mystery wrapped around an enigma?
Oh, yeah.
Something like that. Remember? And I really like that. I meant to look it up before I came. But I think that's it. There's space, which is, what can you say about it? You know, it's you can say a lot. It's bright, it's open, and then there's the appearance of something around it. Could be a blue looking Buddha, you know, that's what we've been told is actually medicine Buddha, or it could be look like somebody in a red, you know, fleece, and that's another shell wrapped around the space. And I think, you know, when I practice, I just say that when I practice sitting, sometimes I say to myself, you know, they say sentient beings are as limitless as space. And so what I do sometimes is say all of my ancestors, countless ancestors are with me. When I sit, I'm not sitting alone. You know, even in my little room, in my house. But they're all there because I'm opening to space as much as I can, and space is me. So that's what I think. But I don't think that's a very good answer. Anybody else have an idea? What a sentient being is?
Well, your definition expanded mine because I just realized I have more of a separateness, that there's me and then there's a whole bunch of other sentient beings that I'm thinking of, carbon-based, or maybe they're little pathogens I don't know about, or bacteria. And so I was thinking more of kind of carbon-based things, but when you're talking about the broader picture, I thought, oh, I like that one a little bit better. It's just more space to it.
Good thing. I mean, you know, being a member, Trungpa Rinpoche would say, sometimes say, oh, you don't see them? Or, you know, like, oh, there's a lot of different ones here, too. Anyway.
you use the expression, there's energies.
Yeah.
How did you say that?
That seems to ring true. Didn't you ask the question? What was the question that you asked him? You said, once you reach nirvana, does it all just disappear?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he said
there's energies.
Yeah. He sort of, you're very kind, he said, no, there's integers. I'm sure, you know, like, this is such an elementary question, you know, like, how much is 1 plus 1 or something like that? It's so basic. But, you know, he said, no, there are energies. And so, you know, I was, what do you think?
Well, the energies congeal in sentient beings.
That's one way to see it. Could be, couldn't it? You know, you might be Medicine Buddha yourself in this form. That's what Kang Rinpoche says. When you work with Medicine Buddha, you know, if you want to be, you are Medicine Buddha in this form. You know, has the energy of Medicine Buddha manifesting as well. So, that's the energy. Yes? No?
Mm-hmm. There's a connection to relativity and conditional.
Yeah.
That aspect seems to be what starts to congeal those energies into things that seem solid.
Yeah.
But it's they're not separate from the unconditional and absolute. That they're, you see through them to experience. It's all one, and they're just,
you
know, yes, something like that.
Yeah, I think you see that what's going on is that every moment, every experience, there is the, you know, we talk about the three kayas. So dharmakaya, sambhogakaya. So the dharmakaya is beyond concept, suchness. You know, that's my, I think, one way to see it. And then harmonic would be just this, what we think of as physical manifestation. And I think sambhogakaya, I would think that this is more aligned with what are energies, because they are the path, like for me, I mean, this is just my guess at this point, but I haven't studied the text much, but are the ways, the joint, you know, the junction between suchness and ordinary vision of experience. So when I think of Medicine Buddha and see this form, to me that's like a sambhogakaya. It means complete, you know, sambhogakaya, I think, means complete enjoyment body. Mm-hmm. Nirmanakaya means emanation, you know, like, oh, 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 oh. Sambhogakaya, you know.
It's form and emptiness together, sort
yes.
of the Art Sutra, sambhogakaya.
Yeah, it's form and that's right. And it is a more open form of the energy, pure energy. And I suppose the Dharmakaya has the energy form too, but it doesn't have the actual physical form at all. It's beyond physical form. So one of the things that that was read in the literature, in the reading that Lydia did, was about, I would say, the energy of green, and that is that in Mobile City? I can't remember, or might be Mobile City.
Yeah, the Mobile City, yeah.
Pardon?
Green is the Mobile City.
Mobile City, yeah. So that's the you know, we have, when we practice Medicine Buddha, we have the five wisdoms. We're crowned with the five wisdoms. Actually crowned with these wisdom energies. And so there's, you know, the one center, which is the Buddha, then I'm not sure if this one is, I can't replace it with a Buddha, they're, you know, like, arranged in points of the compass. So as we work with this, we begin to invoke the clarity of those energies in our thoughts, in our actions, and so forth. And, yeah, our life. Any other questions before we close? Well, yes?
That's sort of not really a question. Are there colors associated with the three poisons? Passion, aggression, ignorance? Are there colors? You know, I would think passion is red.
Mm.
It might be my guess. But ignorance and aggression and actually aggression would be red. Passion, are they colors?
Well, the colors are normally associated with the five wisdoms. So the poisons are sort of condensed because the passion could either be padma or ratna. Aggression can either be karma or vajra, you know?
Doesn't there sometimes is a three-colored manifestation, like three swirls?
Yeah, there might be. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So there, any other questions? Anyway. Well, let's see if there's anything else I wanted to say. One thing that I wanted to do, I'm glad I looked at this here, was that one of the things about cultivating bodhicitta, was, as Gampopa says, every hour to remind yourself. In some version says every session, and then some says every hour. Remind yourself to just say, from now until I have attained enlightenment, I take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Noble Sangha. By performing the acts of liberality or generosity and the other virtues, may I realize Buddhahood for the benefit of the world. So, you see, the whole point of Buddhahood is you can't realize it for your own benefit. Mm-hmm. That's not Buddha. That's Pratyeka Buddha. So, Pratyeka Buddha is not bad. I've heard that Dzongtsar Kenshi says that that's not bad. It's just that it takes innumerable eons before they flip open and wake up that's not the end of the path. But we remind ourselves that the whole point of attaining enlightenment is so that we can help others. So you know there's the three versions of how we work with others. And you hear about the shepherd, the general, and the ship's captain. Well, I'll tell you that, and that'll be the last thing. How do you relate to working with others and your own enlightenment? Well, the shepherd says, I've declined to get enlightened until everybody else has got enlightened in front of me, because I have to make sure that I don't miss anybody. If I'm enlightened, I may not care so much, so I want everybody to go, and then I'll finally get enlightened. Then the ship captain says, we'll all attain it together. And then the general, the head of the army, says, I will lead the way first, and then I'll make sure everybody follows. And so what we say here is that with medicine Buddha practice, that they're all three are fine, but what we're working with here is the general's way, because if you don't get enlightened, or in essence make a connection with that, it's much harder to be a benefit to others. So we do actually get enlightened. We get ourselves almost there. But we only do it because that's the way that we help others.